Okay, thank you, Scott. I appreciate that. And I appreciate the chance to get up and talk a little bit about the work that we're doing on rangelands. Rangelands is an area of research that has sort of not gotten the emphasis that croplands has in terms of the erosion prediction technologies. If you go back to the 1930s and what John was talking about in terms of Hugh Hammond Bennett and the Dust Bowl and the early soil erosion stations were really all located in cropland environments, and there was just very, very little work done in rangelands at that time, and continuing on until now. We just one thing when I moved from croplands to rangelands, I thought when I was working in croplands, it would always be nice just to have a little bit more data, right? It would be nice to have some data for rangelands, and you just don't have those erosion plot data that we have. So what we did was this is a cooperative effort between ARS and NRCS, working very, very closely with the Boise, Idaho group and Fred Pearson and his group there, Du Bois, Corey Moffitt's in Du Bois, Idaho, the Tucson group's involved, and also NRCS in Fort Worth. And we also work with Bill Elliott, and Bill's name was mentioned a bit before in the Forest Service in Moscow, Idaho. And our objective was we wanted to design a model that would be specific for rangelands. We want a science-based sound technology for predicting and runoff and erosion rates on rangelands to assist in assessing rangeland conservation practice effects. And also just to get some numbers on what the soil erosion rates are out there on rangelands. It's a huge area of the country. The problem we have is, we would have used USLE, but I lost my USLE book. I don't know what happened to it, but so we decided not to go with the USLE. The USLE was just never really accepted by the rangeland community. In fact, if you go to the Society for Range Management, that's a sort of an official policy statement in their society is we don't believe the USLE works on rangelands. So from a political perspective, that was kind of a non-starter. WEP, somewhat similar situation. I think the thing is, and this is another thing I found out moving to the West, is it's like speaking a different language, because the terminology that's used is just not the same. You know, they don't think about things the same way, and in fact, the problems aren't the same. So what we decided to do was to kind of start over and develop a rangeland specific erosion model, and we wanted to be able to capture the influence of different plant types, ecosystem types, disturbances such as fire, climate change, and also to assess rangeland practice effects on erosion rates and processes. So this is the propaganda slide here. The only erosion model where then the basic erosion equation is based on rangeland data. We have parameters for the data from 45 rangeland sites across the western United States. We took the data that was collected in the WEP experiments with the EARWET experiments that were collected after that and combined those into a database, and we use those. And so we have parameter estimation equations that are specific for different rangeland plant types. And at this point in time, I'll get into that more, but at this time we have them divided into bunch grasses, sod grasses, and shrubs. The model itself, the code itself, is taken from WEP. So we have basically taken the WEP code and we've stripped it down, and we've tried to take out everything that we could that was based on cropland experiments and try to start. But in terms of the skeleton of the code, it is a WEP code. It's a single storm model. We're not doing continuous simulation at all. Some of the differences, though. We have a new splash and sheet erosion concept, I think. We feel that this concept of the rill and the interrill just doesn't quite fit what we see in rangelands. We don't see interrills with rills on a 1 meter sort of spacing like you see in cropland. And in fact, a lot of times in a lot of rangelands, you really don't see rills. at least on the hill slope, until they've really gotten channelized and you're sort of talking more of an ephemeral gully type situation, unless it's a disturbance. So if you have a fire, if you have severe overgrazing, this is the time where that your real erosion starts to kick in, and then that becomes important. So we don't call it real and intermural erosion, we call it splash and sheet erosion, and then we have concentrated flow erosion. We have a new equation. We took the data that we have from these 45 sites, these experiments, reanalyzed that data, and we have a new equation developed from that. So it's not just the parameterization, but it's also the basic erosion equation that's a little different. Our parameters for the model are based on rangeland vegetation types, cover, and soil properties. WEP assumes a baseline condition with bare soil, no vegetation, and then from that, the parameters then are modified to take into account anything that's different from that. So the amount of cover that's on the surface, consolidation, so forth. We find it very difficult to be able to apply that basic kind of concept to the rangeland environment, because we don't have a baseline condition. We don't till our soils. We don't usually have bare soil conditions, and so we don't go that route. But we base it on basically the dominant rangeland vegetation types, and as I say, cover amounts and soil properties. One of this language issue I talked about before in terms of the ecosystems, that the rangeland scientists think in terms of ecological sites, states within ecological sites. They think about the range condition. Those are some of the ways that they conceive of and characterize rangeland sites. And we tried to pattern our parameterization schemes kind of after that kind of terminology. And originally we tried various things in terms of our parameterizations. We had bunches and bunches of different categories of different ecosystem types and tried to derive parameters. But the problem is, when you only have 45 sites, even though that sounds like quite a lot, when you only have 45 sites and you'd start to just to divide those out, sometimes you're left with only one or two sites that are representing a certain ecosystem type. So what we're doing, at least at this stage, is, and the way we're thinking now is in terms of sodgrass, bunchgrass, and shrubs. And so that's a work in progress, but that's kind of where we are now. This recognizes that the effects of the soil and vegetative cover are different for different plant types. Not all cover is equal in these environments. So you have vegetation spacing and the geometric relationship between shrubs on the surface versus sodgrass on the surface is very different. And so the same amount of cover that you would have under a sodgrass might have a different impact on your erosion rates, for example, than in a shrub site. We don't use the approximate method in WEP. We use the full kinematic wave equations for overland flow rating, except when we have multiple overland flow elements, we have to use the approximate method. That depressional storage is just another example. That was based on experiments in cropland, and we've updated that for rangelands. The aggregate size, the sediment size estimations that are done in WEP. Now, Dennis, I know you have a different way of doing that, and you can also just put directly your sediment size. But in WEP, I think the default way that the sediment size distribution was calculated for the model was using regression relationships, which were based on data collected in cropland situations, and we don't do that. And so we've taken that out. You put your aggregate sediment size classes in directly, and we're working on ways that we can come up with the interface to give that parameter to the model. Heterogeneity is a big issue in rangelands too, because if you take a 2-meter by 3-meter plot and you look at that and you're looking down on it in a rangeland, you have a lot more heterogeneity from one plot to another than we typically see in most cropland situations. So one way we address that is by trying to look at a little bit larger area is our unit size. So when we're looking at a unit size area for modeling in rangelands, we're looking at a bigger area. So for example, we don't use a 1x1 meter plot for parameterizing the model because we don't think it's big enough to be able to capture the heterogeneity of the spatial distribution of the plants. We use the larger plots as our base unit for parameterizing the splash and sheet erosion equation. Just to get clear what we feel that the RHEM is or what it's intended to be, we look at RHEM as being a core engine for single storm runoff and erosion rate estimation. In other words, we're not looking, at least at this stage, as a big model which will do everything. Plant growth, continuous simulation, updating of soil moisture, and so forth. Originally we had intended to do that, but it turns out there's a lot of interest out there by a lot of different groups just to have this basic core engine, and then they want to take that and put it into their model or combine it with other models. And so what we're really focusing on at this point is just to have a good core engine for doing this erosion estimation for individual storm events. The second thing, that the way we look at this a little bit differently, is we have what I think of as a system of parameter estimation equations and procedures. So we don't want to come out with just one set of equations that work for rangelands, but what we want to have is a database and the SAS files so that we can develop new equations to meet different needs. For example, BLM, they're interested, for example, in bare ground because they've had some energy development, or that's a particular problem they got. We can go back to the database and we can rerun our parameter estimation equations specifically focusing on bare ground and develop a new set of equations. And I'll give you an example of that. And then the third part of this project is to develop a web-based interface to run the single storm model. And I kind of hidden it down at the bottom, but that's the important part is we want to also be able to conduct a risk assessment, because we feel that in rangelands, similar to forest lands, there are certain times when that site might be susceptible to having a large event occur, an extreme event. For example, if you have a burn come in, what's the risk that you're going to get your 50-year storm within the first two-year period after you have a wildfire burn or a prescribed fire burn? So one thing we're doing is we're looking at it more in terms of a risk assessment, or our intention is to look at it more in terms of a risk assessment rather than a annual average, although in combination with other models it could also be done in terms of annual averages too. The core engine, you see here, inputs being the storm information, slope, soil, and the hydrology and erosion parameters. Now, where the plants come into this is through that last, the hydrology and erosion parameters. Those are going to be a function of these plant community types and also the state of those plant community types. And then it follows through to the core model, where the hydrology and erosion is calculated, and the output then is sediment yield and hydrograph. The new sheet and splash equation I mentioned previously is based on the data from the rangelands. I'm not going to go into a lot of details about how that was derived, but we'll hopefully be having a paper come out on that next year, and you'll be able to read about it. But this is based on the data, and I'm not going to say a whole lot more about it. I think we can talk. I'd be happy to talk to you about it if you'd like to. The data for the parameters and also for the model itself, or the modification of the model itself, came from as I said, from a lot of different sites across the western U.S., two different experimental data sets. And it looks like a lot, but Leonard, we were talking about this last week. It's just not that much, really, when you start to think about the fact that Oregon has nothing and you're looking at one site in Montana and one in Washington, These are states that have a huge amount of diversity in terms of the ecosystem types that are there. So it's a pretty limited data set, even given what we have. But so that's why we try to really do what we did, and that's separate the data into the shrub, the sod grass, and the bunch grass, which is the three primary types of vegetation communities, and then develop our statistical equations within those plant communities. Again, I mentioned we have the system of parameter estimation equations and the procedures, the database, the SAS program, and the idea being then we can produce or modify quickly new parameter estimation equations as needed. For example, this is a set of parameter estimation equations for the KE value, which is the main infiltration parameter for the shrub, the bunch grass, and the sod grass. And I have two sets of equations up there. The ones in green are based on biomass. So if you look across there, it's got a mistake in it. But anyway, what it's supposed to have is that the green equations are supposed to be strictly the biomass. What we've got here actually is biomass and cover in the green. And then if I don't have that biomass information, I have a second set of equations which are just based on percentage of cover. And those can be adjusted and modified depending on what kind of data set you have. For example, if you have an NRI data set, you might have a certain set of information that you can use to run the model. If you're looking at ecological site descriptions, you may have a different set of information. If you're looking at remote sensing data, and that's a big one for us because we're covering a lot of land, and that's something we're looking into seriously is remote sensing, you might have a different set of information that you can use to put into your model. So we want to have that flexibility. Applications. That's NRI. As far as I know, we're not using MRI, but we are using NRI data to parameterize the model and run for each site. So what we're in the process of doing in the next few months is to be able to take the NRI data that's collected at natural resource inventory data that are taken across the western U.S. and I think we have something like 17,000 sites, if I'm not mistaken, where the field data has been collected on the ground, and we want to be able to take that information and be able to have the capacity then to run it through the model and come up with estimates. If you look at the NRI information for 1997, for example, you'll see that there's no erosion data reported for rangelands, and we'd like to rectify that if we can. SEEP Rangelands, Conservation Effects Assessment Project. How's my time?
Six minutes,
okay. So the Conservation Effects Assessment Project has finally made it to the West, and it's been going on for about 5 years in the East, and we're finally getting started in the West. We had a meeting in Reno last week to come up with some of the ideas for that, and I think the RHEM is going to play a pretty big role in the assessment of the effect of conservation practices in the western United States. We're in the process of developing a web-based interface. We have a preliminary or a prototype interface that was developed out of Boise. We're going to build on that. And part of that interface will be to do the things like to be able to take the NRI data, translate it to those parameter values for erosion and infiltration that I mentioned before, and put it through the model. So in other words, what we want to be able to do is be able to with the interface talk to the user in the language that they're accustomed to using. For example, you're talking to a range scientist; they have a certain way of characterizing their site. We want to be able to take that information in the interface, translate that to the parameters, and run the model. And I mentioned before, we're not intending to run a continuous simulation at this time, but we plan to look at it in terms of a risk-based assessment. John, you mentioned SWOT with WEP. We do have, we met with Jeff Arnold and the crew from Texas last week, and we have intention to be able to take the RHM output and then feed that to the SWOT model and do these basin scale assessments in the rangeland with the SWOT using the input from the RHEM for sediment and runoff. ARIS has a model for plant growth, which is called Almanac. Jim Canary out of Temple. And we're going to work with Jim, and that's a continuous simulation model. So there's a potential there for to bring Almanac in with RHEM and to have work those two together to basically have a continuous simulation model for erosion if you combine those two together. Somebody mentioned, I think it was Dennis earlier, the DWEP. I can't remember who mentioned it actually, but we have a dynamic solution for the WEP equations. We're planning to that with very few modifications, we should be able to have that RHEM running in Kinneros as well, so that we can use the same inputs that we use for RHEM and run the Kinneros model too. We still have a little bit to go in terms of the parameter estimation procedures, primarily for the concentrated flow erosion, erodibilities and hydraulic friction factors and flow widths. That's being done out of Du Bois. And as I said, we're also working on the NRI data and the risk assessment and the interface. We do have one paper out that was published in the Transactions last year, and a couple more in the process. And I think that's it. We're kind of excited about it. I mean, we're excited about the idea that we'll have a model that will be specific for rangelands, and hopefully our target, of course, is to have this accepted by the rangeland conservation community.
Are there any questions for Mark?
Yes.
Mark. Yeah, Matt. Yeah. What's say the last sentence again? Right. Well, the size is basically defined at this point by our experimental plot, the large experimental plots that were run for the WEP and the EARWET runs. And so we're talking about, you know, a couple meters by 3 meters, something like that. Don't remember the exact number, but that's pretty close. So that's exactly what you're saying is exactly what we're really talking about, and that is that the flow paths, that when you're talking about an area that size, your flow paths, for example, on grasslands, we have debris dams that form, and those debris dams tend to block up the flow. They tend to deposit sediment, and if you have a 1 by 1 meter plot, you're not really dealing with something that's big enough to be able to take that into account. And yet, it's not really a real erosion process, but it's definitely a process that occurs on these plots of this size. I was involved early on in 88, I guess it was, in Tucson with parameterizing the WEP model for real erosion. And I helped in the analysis of that data. And one thing that we saw was that these plots really didn't exhibit a real erosion the way we expected to for and that was we came up with a method and we came up with some numbers, but frankly, did you, John? Okay, so they were a little bigger than what
yeah,
I said.
Yeah, but still, kind of like you say,
yeah.
The rangelands, we built our own reels on croplands, but the rangelands, it just didn't, I never believed the numbers came out.
Yeah, right. And I've done experiments in rangelands in Tucson, and we have grass sites and we have shrub sites. And it's interesting to me, it's more interesting to watch the water after it leaves the plot than when it's on the plot, because it comes off as a, it leaves your flume, as your measuring flume as a channel. And in grassland, you'll walk 20 feet out and it'll be out like this. It'll be just fingering down the slope. And then you walk down in the shrublands where you've got pretty big spaces between your vegetation. It's like one of the slides at the park, you know, you're riding down. It's just a totally different environment, and the water moves across in a completely different way on your shrub versus your grassland. So you have to have, I think, a little bit bigger area to be able to capture those kinds of differences.
On rangelands, it's always seemed to me that most of our storms seem to occur whenever there was no antecedent moisture, very, very low.
Sometimes. It depends on where you are in the west, but yeah.
On croplands, the really bad storms occurred after about a day after you had your first storm to wet the soil, and antecedent moisture is very, very important.
Right. Yeah, I think that you're right. I mean, I think certainly in the semi-arid, dry, hot areas, southwest, probably antecedent moisture is not as big a factor. It's going to be dry. It's going to be dry and drier most of the time.
The thing then is, if you can model it with the single storms that you want,
yeah.
You don't have to worry about continuous simulation.
Well, I made that argument, but the folks up in the northwest don't agree with me on that. So. They've got a little different environment.
I mean, I selected the cropland sites in South Dakota and Oklahoma.
Yeah.
I made that sure they never used the data, but everybody did use it. But they were a lot different than the ones down in Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that issue is antecedent moisture comes a little more to the fore when you get a little further north and you don't have quite the evaporation rates. But the other thing I was going to say is snow. When you get to the bigger areas, and especially you get up into the mountainous region, that snow becomes a big issue, and the sediment associated with the snow is still is a big issue in a lot of the West, and certainly the water supply is affected a lot by the snow too.